The following is a rebroadcast of Studio Tulsa. This program first aired last year.
Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Although our language and usage are continually evolving, don't tell that to the grammar police. Who are the grammar police? Well, they're a wide cross-section of Americans who believe that the rules of correct English discourse are sacrosanct and unchanging and unyielding. My guest today tells the story of an event that set the grammar police's hair on fire. It's the story of the creation of the Merriam-Webster Third Dictionary back in 1961. That's when the dictionary departed from prescriptive authority, telling us the words and language we should use, to depicting the words and language we actually use. As one of my grammar police friends says, it's when the dictionary became namby-pamby. And that whole departure can be summed up in one small contraction. Ain't. Now, if you grew up when I did, you probably remember ain't a word. But the decision to include this word and many others ignited a national firestorm back in the 60s, with detractors predicting no less than the end of civilization. David Skinner's book, The Story of Ain't, America, Its Language, and the Most Controversial Dictionary Ever Published, tells that story, as well as a much larger story, how we created and established American English with all its beauty, warts, and curious idioms. David Skinner is a writer and editor. He writes a column on language for the Weekly Standard. He's also the editor of Humanities Magazine and is on the usage panel of the American Heritage Dictionary. He joins us today on Studio Tulsa. David Skinner, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on, Rich.
This book, while it is ostensibly the story of Webster's Third, which started putting slang into the Webster Dictionary, this is really a bigger story. It's a story of really the creation of American English and this divide between our English forebears and the vital way we use American English.
I agree. I think this story begins with Noah Webster and his attempt to build an American dictionary. Some of his innovations included, quoting American authors, which was totally new to dictionaries at the time, and introducing Americanisms, American terms, and American examples of American usage to the dictionary. Before Webster, we were all basically relying on Samuel Johnson's dictionary, and he wanted that to end. He thought America would benefit greatly from having its own dictionary. He thought it was politically vital.
But by the end of the 19th century, though, we're back under the influence of the English, it sounds like.
Definitely. Part of the story of the 19th century American English is that we have an incredible inferiority complex about how we use the English language versus how the British used the English language. And some of the commentators of the day even apologized to the British for how we deviate from their example in our own usage. But all this kind of comes to an end in the 20th century when H.L. Mencken publishes his book, The American Language, and stands up for American English. And he really embraces the language as you might find it in the books of Mark Twain or newspapers of the 19th century, really dialectal English. And it becomes very influential. And it also, I think, helps American writers start to take pride in how they use the language. Not long after, we see the first great American writers to sort of straddle the earth. They're not the first great American writers, of course, but we have a surprising number of them in the 1920s and the 1930s. I'm talking about, Fitzgerald and Hemingway and Faulkner and others. Mm-hmm. And certainly they benefited from this great pride that we had begun to take in our own language.
One of the things I found really interesting about the book was this is a particularly American argument, because the divide between learned English, if you will, and colloquial use and everyday usage is every bit as big in England, where that distinction is absolutely ignored, versus America, where we debate it and people get worked up into a froth about it. I found that really interesting.
Well, I think all over the English-speaking world, we have variations on this debate. I mean, all of us put so much effort into speaking well. And I mean, I'm a professional writer and editor. It's something I work on every single day of my life. And we become very invested in the standards we create for ourselves or that we learned from even, teachers in fourth grade or fifth grade. I to this day, I have adults, professionals with lots of degrees on their walls telling me that reciting some rule that they learned in grammar school that they consider inviolable. And it's funny how it is. I think because our speech and our writing says so much about us intellectually, it's a kind of mirror into our mind. We're very defensive about what it suggests about us, ourselves.
And of course, going back to when you were writing the book about this time, that absolutely divided us between the educated and the uneducated at a time when all of a sudden you have this huge social change of this educational movement, where instead of leaving school very early or maybe not even learning to read, Americans were becoming educated.
Yes. I mean, I think one of the amazing things I started to appreciate when I was researching the book was just the climbing numbers of Americans who become educated between the late 19th century and, say, World War II with the GI Bill, so many returning soldiers into colleges and universities. You could see how this would transform not only society and help, you know, create a sort of educated, a large, very large, educated middle class, but it would transform our feelings about language and how we use the language. But also during these same years, Americans are not only becoming more educated, but what it means to be educated is changing. You know, starting in the 19th century, to be educated meant that you knew classical languages. It was really a more literary, classical, liberal arts education. But in the 20th century, you know, the era of airplanes, of cars, of the atom bomb, to be educated means to have a great deal of technical and scientific knowledge.
Yeah, science and medicine. Science and medicine.
And science and medicine. Medicine grows exponentially during these years. There's a moment I read about in the 1920s when the guy who's one of the big writers in surgery realizes he can no longer update his own book about surgery because there's so much new information in his own field that he needs to co-author with a number of authors just to update his own work. We have, in so many of these disciplines, like medicine and like, you know, engineering, we have these knowledge explosions going on very regularly in the 20th century that create a great deal of new vocabulary, but also train people, educated people, to see the world differently, to see the world in technical and scientific terms. And with World War II, we have a very complicated war, a great logistical war. A war of management and global supply chains and a very complicated war. And the language of the war is incredibly complicated sounding. It sounds like a bureaucrat crossed with an engineer. It's the kind of language that gives us phrases like the military-industrial complex.
Right.
It's a very technical way of viewing the world. And acronyms. Acronyms become very important to the public discourse, not only during the Great Depression, but the war itself, and help turn into words like, you know, snafu.
Well, the book, The Story of Ain't, begins with actually the second Webster's Dictionary, which I found really rather enlightening how much the dictionary creators were, and basically the people who are creating things like the Harvard Library, the extent to which they're out there to protect us from Shakespeare's more bawdy passages to just any word that has even the slightest risque meaning. Webster's second, basically, we're not going to talk about this. This is just terrible. It's just amazing how quickly our society and how our lexicon changed.
Yeah, in 1934, they seem like very late Victorians when they go to write the definition for menage. Well, they put it in a definition for menage because they don't want to define menage a trois. Which is actually a term that's well known in English at this point. Well, a couple different writers use it, including, I think, Eugene O'Neill. But they don't want to put menage a trois in the dictionary, so they put menage, and they just define it as a household. And so everything that you might be wondering about is left unsaid.
And this comes at the end of the Jazz Age, when you've had all this slang that's become a part of the language and the vernacular and heard on now electronic media, and none of this is reflected in that second edition.
And some of it seems very clean by our standards, like the word leggy. If you look up leggy in Webster's second in 1934, they define it as having something to do with legs. And as a verbal illustration, they give a leggy horse.
Well,
so,
been...
So in 1961, when they update Leggy, they have to account for, you know, all the calendar girls there. The returning veterans have been collecting on their walls, like Betty Grable and others who are Leggy in a very different sense.
Well, tell us about the creation of Webster Third and the firestorm this created, because, well, you had people like Dwight McDonald, who you've profiled in your book. This is a critic, a literary critic and writer, who said this is the end of the world as we know it.
Which is very strange. I think a lot's going on. So the people who make the dictionary, they're readers of linguistics. They reflect a very modern and scientific view of the language. And so they see the job of a dictionary as to honestly report how the language is used and not prejudge the language, not, you know, protect readers from dirty words or naughty insinuation. They want to candidly, but with a lot of kind of scientific objectivity, report on usage, report on pronunciation, and even that's kind of controversial. Up until 1934, Webster's relied very heavily on the New England accent to describe how words were pronounced, and they often ignored other major accents, you know, Western, Midwestern, Southern, and so forth. So the new dictionary was going to be more honest and more accurate about describing the language itself and not set itself up as some kind of supreme arbiter of everything worth knowing and, you know, some all-knowing guide to how language really should be used. No, this dictionary was going to report on how it was used. And so they were sort of unknowingly walking into, a firestorm. With the end of the war in the 1950s, there's actually a great debate going on over American culture. You know, popular culture is becoming the culture. And there's some backlash against that. There are some people like Dwight McDonald who are looking back to how culture was defined in, you know, when they were growing up. And they're suddenly drawing very clear distinctions between what is high culture, what is middle culture, and what is low culture. And this gives us the well-known distinction between highbrow and lowbrow.
Now, I was really surprised that, you know, pop culture comes into the vernacular in the 1950s. Was there other terminology for, was that low culture or middle brow or lowbrow? What was the terminology prior to the creation of that term pop culture? Because that appears in the 50s.
I'm not entirely sure, but when we use the word culture, we weren't talking about what we today call popular culture.
No, we're talking about classicism and Renaissance and Greek.
If you
Latin.
Look at Webster's, if you look at Webster's Second in 1934, that dictionary really wanted to describe all sorts of things. As it defined culture, it included, you know, say great English essayists of the 19th century, but it didn't include jazz. You know, it included old French kings, but it didn't include American baseball. When we spoke of culture, we were always speaking of something older, distant, and possibly European in origin. But starting in the 40s and 50s, when we're realizing that, you know, the movies we go to, the radios we listen to, and the TVs that we're increasingly buying at the end of World War II, all of this represents, well, our culture. And America is, after World War II, the most, you know, powerful country in the free world. There's a weird realization that's going on after World War II that, you know, what we do is also culture. And so there are suddenly very tough fights over defining that culture and sort of compartmentalizing it into worthy culture and unworthy culture.
My guest today is David Skinner, writer and editor. He's the editor of Humanities Magazine and the author of The Story of Ain't, America, Its Language, and the Most Controversial Dictionary Ever Published. He's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. It's a fascinating look at this battle over how are we going to define our language. And as your title suggests, in many cases it comes down to the word ain't. I always remember to the old saw, you know, ain't a word because ain't in the dictionary, but actually, even in that previous edition, the second Webster's, ain't is all over the place. People are using it. Ain't she sweet? Ain't misbehaving? It's all over what we would later call popular culture. Yet it doesn't appear in the second, and it becomes a huge battle in the third.
Well, it does appear in the second, but it's labeled very clearly dialectal illiterate. It's like, we'll let you know that this is a word, but please don't use it.
Ever.
Ever. Promise. But by 1961, they judged that description totally inadequate. They think that does not describe the word. There's a lot of literature attesting to the fact that ain't is used even by educated people, especially in phrases like, you know, I'm your father, ain't I? And I'm a great patriot, ain't I? You know, that kind of end of the sentence after an assertion. And also, its ubiquity in literature by this point is just impossible to ignore. I mean, before Webster Second, you had the example of Mark Twain, who used the word very liberally in his books. But by 1961, you have a whole slew of other writers who are using it for a variety of literary effects. If you look in William Faulkner, if you look in John Steinbeck, if you look in Zora Neale Hurston, you find many, many uses of the word haint and its variations. And so it's probably time to reassess ain't, which is really the most, you know, maybe the most infamous non-curse word in the language. I mean, for generations, you know, school teachers have been trying to stamp out ain't and stop their students from saying it, please. So it's probably a much more controversial decision than they realize. And they describe it as, well, they give a very full description of it, saying it's widely disapproved of and more common in less educated speech. But it's also used by cultivated speakers in most parts of the U.S. Now that word cultivated is what drives people crazy. It's the thing. It's like it's the underline, the italicization. So the usage note gets just partly quoted in a press release that goes out from Merriam-Webster and sets off a firestorm of headlines about the new dictionary.
Now tell us a little bit about the man who led the effort for the third Webster's, and that's Philip Gove. You know, he has this very liberalizing view of what the dictionary should be. Yet I think one of the first big descriptions of him in the book is how he takes several days' worth of correspondence with a child's teacher to explain an absence in which she sends home very generic questions. He goes, there's no way I can possibly answer this. I mean, it's just, you know, it's a very funny passage in the book. This guy could be as prickly and member of the language police in good standing. But yet he has this liberalizing view of language.
Yeah, in his own way, he's an incredible stickler. And I find that very funny because he's famous as a kind of linguistic relativist, as acknowledging no rules. And I mean, people call him an anarchist or a communist or all sorts of things. But he's by training an editor. And to this, I can really relate. I'm a professional editor. And he knows that in his own work in the dictionary, he realizes that what you really have to do most of the time is set good rules for the writing of your products, and everyone needs to follow those rules really carefully. But also in his personal life, he's kind of a difficult guy. There are plenty of stories attesting to him being kind of reserved and unfriendly, but also he's got he objects seriously to other people's use of language, and he gets very fed up while he's in the Navy with the bureaucraties of the U.S. military, and when he gets these form notes from his child's school teacher, they just drive him crazy. He gets so irritated with these, and everyone, I'm a parent, I get these generic notes from my teacher. I have not told off a single teacher because of it. He, however, writes this incredible, you know, response to his daughter's teacher, basically telling her to get a life and write him a real note if she expects him to answer him. And it's just preposterous. It's like, it's the kind of behavior you expect from someone who has no idea what kind of impression they make on other people. I mean, he's really socially very, very inept. And I think that feeds the controversy, is that he has no clue what kind of problem, you know, what kind of problems he's stirring up for himself when he's making this dictionary and describing ain't as cultivated.
Yes, it's funny that whole story ends with a four-page reply to the teacher's final inquiry, which she writes, would you please fill in the name, residence, and the approximate time that Doris has to leave the house and the time that she usually arrives home in the afternoon. Please sign your name. Thank you. Because she's gone from, like, where do you ride the bus? to get an answer out of the guy.
But you know, he becomes famous as the guy who's trying to sabotage the English language because he He seems to respect no boundaries, no rules, no standards, which is all quite overwrought and quite overstated. But it's an interesting debate between basically two views of the language, both of which strike me as, you know, valid in their realms, but still to this day characterize kind of the polarizing camps in most language debates.
You know, when you look at the job he had to do, because not only is he looking at the huge wave of vocabulary changes due to the war, due to the post-war era, where all of a sudden modern conveniences and we have this huge technological revolution of consumer goods that they're coming into the language. You have to also go back to the 20s and 30s, where you had an equally inspired language burst of new words, and he's going back to there. And it seems like it's interesting. It's like every little era where there's technological innovation just spawns an incredible amount of new words.
Definitely.
I think we're living in one right now.
I think so, too. And Philip Gove had a hard job. It was not an easy job. He had to set himself against a kind of culture of complacency at Merriam-Webster, and he had to create new standards for the dictionary. And he didn't take the easy way out. He could have taken an easier way out. He could have made life easier for himself by insisting on fewer changes to the old dictionary, on adopting more of the old material. But the one thing he definitely had was integrity. And so he really wanted to build a dictionary that had serious intellectual rigor. And that he succeeded. He just also created a dictionary that was very off-putting to a lot of people.
And certainly they did react.
They did react. When the press release came out talking about the word ain't being cultivated, newspapers across the country that were running a headline saying ain't a mistake anymore, ain't wrong, almost immediately there were editorials denouncing this very notion and linking it to the end of civilization. a lot of the early Cold War fears were being projected onto this debate over language. The problem wasn't that there might be a new mediocre dictionary being sold at bookstores. The problem was that this dictionary wasn't going to save the West. It wasn't going to save the United States from Nikita Khrushchev and the USSR. It wasn't going to save us from nuclear fallout. It wasn't, a number of people, it's strange. It's like everyone in the same town having the same nightmare. And it's strange how it keeps popping up in different pieces of writing about this dictionary. It begins with the Toronto Globe and Mail, and then you see it in the Washington Sunday Star. And you see it in a few other places, and finally you see it in Dwight McDonald's piece in The New Yorker, where he writes very intelligently about the dictionary, making some complaints, making some observations, but finally saying, you know, all this really comes down to whether or not it's important that we police other people's usage. And I think it's very important. And he quotes Shakespeare's Troilus and Cressida, and he quotes this long speech by a character named Ulysses. And in the speech, Ulysses describes the end of the world. He describes the seas rising. He describes governments falling. He describes, you know, laws becoming meaningless. He describes man being turned into an animal who preys on other men. And it's a terrible vision that describes a kind of return to the state of nature and the rewinding of civilization. And you read that and you think, are we still reading the same article?
Well, it's funny, you know, those arguments never go away. Think of how language is used in texting and electronic media. We make those same arguments today.
We do, and I get asked a lot about this. You know, do I fear that texting or technology is going to destroy the language? And I can't imagine such a scenario where it would destroy the language. I mean, you know, as far as what effect texting might have on spelling, it's probably debatable, but it's probably minimal.
Yeah. It
might change it, but our spelling is so arbitrary to begin with. I can't I'm not going to grow nostalgic over a spelling like R-I-G-H-T going the way of the horse carriage. That doesn't bother me at all.
At one point, a double S was F.
There are a lot of these things that, you know, really, if they changed to something else that was equally arbitrary, you know, my life would not be affected. I think we underestimate how complicated and powerful a thing language is for all of us, and how it's so much a part of our lives that we wouldn't think of doing anything important without really calling on the deepest linguistic resources available to us. I mean, whether we're applying for a job or trying to get someone to fall in love with us, if we're trying to communicate something very important to someone across the country, whatever it is that we're doing, if we're at the DMV filing paperwork, we are always trying our best to make ourselves understood. And I don't know anyone who would just ignore completely the intellectual assets that centuries of linguistic development have put at our disposal, every one of us, to speak exclusively in some really like a minority slang convenience dialect like that which we use for texting, messages to our spouses like, what should I get at the grocery store?
Yeah. I have to ask one last question. I know that you're on the usage panel of the American Heritage Dictionary. When disputes arise, do people come up with terms like the end of civilization as we know it in your own disputes?
Well, when disputes arise, what we do is we meet on the edge of town with swords and we have it out. We settle it like men.
All right.
Like knights.
Well, really, is it genteel or is it combative, verbally combative?
It's like a correspondence society. You know, once a year or so, they send you a survey with anywhere between, 20 and 60 items, asking your opinions on various pronunciations or various, usages. Say something like, you'll have something like a word like curate, which, you know from a museum setting, but which is being used increasingly in other settings. And the survey will ask you, well, do you approve of, someone saying, I curated a rock festival, or I curated a flea market, or, I curated a yard sale. Do you find this objectionable? And you answer. And then they just basically use the results to tally percentages on these. And
oh my God, it's a democracy.
It's very modern. It's supposed to be very old-fashioned and moss-backed, but it's actually very modern. And so they make these percentages available to the person who writes their usage notes in the dictionary. And the American Heritage Dictionary has these very good usage notes throughout, highlighting various usage disputes and often offering a good bit of perspective and historical context on these disagreements.
Well, I enjoyed the book very much. The Story of Ain't. David Skinner, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Rich. Thank you very much for having me on.
David Skinner is the editor of Humanities Magazine and the author of The Story of Ain't, America, Its Language, and the Most Controversial Dictionary Ever Published. It's published by Harper Perennial in softcover. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. If you miss one of our recent programs, they're available online anytime at publicradiotulsa.org. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.